WMAL News at 7. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. A 6-year-old girl is shot and killed and 5 adults shot and injured in Southeast D.C. last night. It happened at the intersection of MLK and Malcolm X Avenues in Congress Heights.
Shortly after 11 p.m., 7 district officers received a call. They actually heard the shots fired and responded to this location. A group of individuals was running toward these responding officers.
They showed them where the victims were. Executive Assistant Police Chief Asham Benedict says the 3 men and 2 women had non-life-threatening injuries. Nobody's been arrested. They're looking for a dark-colored vehicle. A federal judge in Texas rules a program that protects immigrants brought to this country illegally as children violated the law when it was created.
But the judge says the hundreds of thousands of current so-called dreamers would not be affected until further court rulings. The judge sided with a group of states suing to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival Program, or DACA, arguing it was illegally created by then-President Obama in 2012. The judge is blocking the government from approving any new DACA applications. Senate Judiciary Chairman Dick Durbin says the ruling is a cruel and misguided act of judicial fiat and is calling for Congress to act. Sean Langell, Fox News.
Oh, baby, you got what I need.
That's the 1989 hip-hop classic Just a Friend. The man behind it, Biz Markie, is dead at 57. No word on how he died, but his representative says he passed peacefully last night with his wife by his side. A recent road rage tragedy has moved law enforcement and highway safety advocates to remind you to move over accident scenes.
During the 4th of July holiday, a AAA tow truck driver was tragically killed in the state of Ohio.
If the errant driver had simply moved over, that tow truck operator would still be alive, says Regina Ali with AAA Mid-Atlantic.
Every day, our law enforcement officers as well as our tow truck drivers are on the road as motorists speed by, and they're not slowing down, they're not moving over.
Ali says it's not just courteous to move over and give crews and cops more space. It's the law in all 50 states. John Matthews on WMAL and WMAL.com.
Heads up, if you're a Red Line Metro rider, starting today, trains will only run every 18 minutes along the entire line as a tunnel ventilation project is done. Extra trains will run between Glenmont and Farragut North from opening until 7 p.m. on weekdays, so riders don't have to wait as long to get to and from work. The inconvenience will last until August 29th. Drive-in movies regained popularity during COVID, but in Arlington, the drive-in movies are sticking around this summer, too.
It's been very popular, but we do require registration. So on our website, columbiapike.org, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter.
Amanda Lovins with the Columbia Pike Revitalization Organization says the slots fill up quickly. The newsletter comes out each Thursday at 10. WMAL Sports, the Nats fell to the Padres 24-8. The Nats allowed the most runs since the franchise moved to Washington in 2005 and tied for the most in D.C. history. Traffic and weather next. WMAL traffic from the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In Arlington, you will find a work zone on 395 southbound after the GW Parkway, causing some delays as you make your way through. The left lane does get through in this work zone. Also, getting reports of some debris in the roadway on 95 southbound in Laurel at 198. Use caution there. Traveling 95 in Virginia, some slowing southbound through Garrisonville between 610 and the Centerport Parkway. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
This will be the last day of the heat wave. High temperatures into the mid-90s. A heat advisory is in effect noon through 8 o'clock this evening, D.C. and points east. Also, a cold front will shift through during the afternoon. A flash flood watch is in effect for the D.C. and Baltimore metros through the overnight hours. Could have some very heavy rainfall, thinking through the afternoon and evening. Some storms may be on the strong to severe side with damaging winds as well. Storms will come to an end overnight for your Sunday. Partly sunny skies, temperatures a little bit cooler back in the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
Now, from the WMAL WinBet Studios, the Saturday Morning Update.
105.9 FM, WMAL. It's hour two of the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. John Gizzi joins us each week. He is the White House correspondent and chief political columnist at Newsmax.com and Newsmax TV. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rick.
John, many questions asked at the White House this week about Cuba policy. Somewhat inactive earlier in the week, toward the end of the week, they came out with a statement, I guess a positioning statement. But your assessment from having been at the White House this week?
There's no doubt that the administration wants to be on the side of the people who are in the streets demanding freedom. That's inarguable. And President Biden put out a statement saying he stood with the people. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said, "We stand against oppression." Now, what that means is the U.S. is going to continue the sanctions that have been long held against Cuba. The conundrum herein is that the demonstrators say they lack food. That's their principal argument, along with a lack of treatment for the COVID-19 virus. So, does the continued sanctioning of Cuba help in any way? Many say that if the government gave a degree of freedom, we would lift sanctions and there would be more food coming to the Cuban people. At the same time, the question comes up, as it does with any dictatorship, how much of the food actually gets to the people. It is a conundrum indeed. At this point, the demonstrations grow larger with each passing day. The security forces of the government in Havana are probably able to keep them down for now, but there may come a point when they refuse to fire on people, and that could lead to something very unexpected and historic in Cuba. We'll keep an eye on this.
I want to turn to the State Department issuing an invitation to the United Nations to investigate the United States on racism, discrimination, and human rights?
Exactly. Racism and minority issues, to be specific. Now, this is something that Secretary of State Tony Blinken announced last week, saying responsible nations must not shrink from scrutiny of their human rights record. Ever since the killing in Minnesota of George Floyd, there has been a steady drumbeat of the R word, racism against the United States, at the United Nations. Specifically, North Korea, China, and Russia have denounced the U.S. as a racist country and a country that tolerates racism. The Floyd death and the resulting riots being cases in point. These are countries which could stand a look at their own treatment of minorities, particularly in China, with the slamming down of the Uyghurs and the capture of Tibet in 1959, and they're still holding the Tibetan people involuntarily as part of China. It should be pointed out that Mr. Blinken said that the UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism and the Rapporteur on Minority Issues will come and issue a report. In any event, this illustrates how different times are from when Donald Trump was president. In 2018, he simply pulled out of the UN Human Rights Commission, and now we're back in and welcoming them to our shores.
So we as a responsible nation can now invite irresponsible nations like China, North Korea, and Russia to come in and investigate us.
Exactly.
Okay. Moving right along, John, you mentioned the former president. He's gotten into it with, of all people, Mark Milley this week?
Yes, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is quoted in a new book by authors Kara Leenig and Phil Rucker, both White House correspondents, about what Donald Trump said and did on January 6th. To be specific, he said this was the then president's Reichstag moment. In other words, suggesting that Donald Trump was in the same position Hitler was in 1933 when the German parliament was burned down. And this, of course, led to the enactment of the Enabling Act and absolute power for Adolf Hitler. That's a pretty strong charge. In addition, he concluded that on that day, the president, and I quote, was preaching the gospel of the Führer. Now, Donald Trump heatedly denies this. He had no coup in mind. He never said any of these things. And as he put it, and let me paraphrase this, if I was planning a coup, General Mark Milley would be the last person I would use. So you have a case of he said here between two top officials. One thing it should be noted about General Milley, you don't get to become chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or even a four-star general without knowing a little bit about politics and a little bit about who to leak information to in the Washington press corps. The second thing is, and this is what makes it all ironic, Donald Trump appointed Army General Mark Milley to the premier position in the U.S. military over the candidate of the Pentagon brass. That's right. Air Force General David Goldfein, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, was backed by then Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis and by the outgoing Joint Chiefs Chairman General Joseph Dunsford. Trump was in a fit with both of them and, as a result, turned to someone who was not their candidate. This is very well known in Pentagon and military circles. And now that General Milley is someone who is public enemy number one to Donald Trump.
Well, according to poll numbers in Virginia, the gubernatorial race just got a little more interesting. What's going on there?
Well, the Trafalgar poll showed that nearly 4 months before Virginians go to the poll, Democrat Terry McAuliffe leads Republican Glenn Youngkin by a wafer-thin 47-45%. Now, what makes those numbers interesting is that at this point in the game, Terry McAuliffe is a former governor of the state, a former Democratic national chairman, well-known as a close friend of Bill and Hillary Clinton. In other words, he's a very public figure. Glenn Youngkin had a high position at the Carlyle Group, made a lot of money, but he's neither held nor sought elective office before running for governor. So to see them in such close competition this early in the game means it's going to be a barn burner of a race. Now, I've talked to some experts on Virginia politics, and they're skeptical of it. Quentin Kidd, a professor at Christopher Newport University and an expert on the Old Dominion state, said this early in the game, and with so many people on vacation and trying to avoid the heat, he was doubtful about the figures. No one's focused on it. There'll be other polls, other debates, and remember, this is a race that's one of only two in the nation for governorships. People are going to be watching.
With all the pressure in the Senate on some of the swing Democrats and Republicans, Lisa Murkowski's been under a lot of pressure, but she is going to stay put?
All signs are she'll stay a Republican. Lisa Murkowski's been in the Senate 20 years. People thought she was finished when she got to the Senate through appointment by her father after he was elected governor of the land of the Midnight Sun. But she's been there all this time, including winning one term as a write-in candidate after she lost the Republican primary. This time there's going to be no Republican primary. Alaska opted in a referendum for rated choice voting. That means that all candidates, regardless of party, appear on the same ballot in the fall, and then in November the top four are on the ballot, and people's second-choice votes are counted. This means that Democrats and independents can flock to the polls and vote for Lisa Murkowski, who faces a challenge from conservative Kelly Shibaka. Now, one other thing. Ms. Shibaka, who served in state government and is a Harvard Law graduate, has the endorsement of a fellow named Donald Trump, who's pretty popular in Alaska. This is going to be a race to watch.
John Gizzi, White House correspondent, chief political columnist at Newsmax.com. As always, John, thank you very much from the perspectives from the White House briefing room.
And to all of our friends out there, stay cool this weekend.
Okay. Coming up next, we'll talk with Gordon Chang. He'll have the latest on the investigation into the origins of COVID-19. But first, we head to the WMAL Traffic Center, and Michelle Murray is there this morning.
In Maryland, traveling in the Laurel area on 95 southbound past 198, watch out for debris reported in the roadway. And also, you will find an accident still in Howard County on southbound Route 1 at Gatewood Drive, and that is blocking the right lane. Traveling in Virginia, watch out for construction on 395 southbound after the GW Parkway along the right side. Left lane gets by. Watch out for a brief delay. And some slowing traffic now on 95 southbound between Garrisonville, Aquia, and the Centerport Parkway. Now from GarageRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
This will be the last day of the heat wave. High temperatures into the mid-90s. A heat advisory is in effect noon through 8 o'clock this evening, D.C. and points east. Also, a cold front will shift through during the afternoon. A flash flood watch is in effect for the D.C. and Baltimore metros through the overnight hours. Could have some very heavy rainfall, thinking through the afternoon and evening. Some storms may be on the strong to severe side with damaging winds as well. Storms will come to an end overnight for your Sunday. Partly sunny skies, temperatures a little bit cooler back in the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
And it is a warm 79 degrees in the nation's capital, 720 on the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
Washington's Mall, WMAL, where Washington comes to talk.
It's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler, glad to have you along on this summer weekend. And great this morning to be joined by Gordon Chang. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China, also The Great U.S.-China Tech War. Gordon, it's great to have you with us.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate it.
Well, you know, I've been following you on Twitter, at Gordon G. Chang. You've been writing a lot about, obviously, the coronavirus and the origins of coronavirus. And, you know, we see stories day in and day out, but nothing seems to be conclusive as to where it's going. What do you see as the latest in the investigation?
There have been a lot of developments in the last couple days. So, for instance, yesterday, CNN reported that the intelligence community believes that a lab leak is a credible idea. You know, there's two theories, lab leak and natural mutation. President Biden on May 26 ordered the IC to come up with something on the origins of the disease. Well, the lab leak theory is gaining some momentum. Also, Director General Tedros of the World Health Organization, he actually said that his organization dismissed the lab leak theory and it shouldn't have done that. He said that, look, he was a researcher. He worked in a lab. He saw that lab accidents were common, that this is something that the WHO needs to look at. So there's more and more momentum pointing to a lab leak. We don't have 100% yet, but that's the direction where all of these developments are pointing. And, of course, then we have the Chinese continuing their position that they've taken since last month, that no more investigations on Chinese soil as to the origins of this disease.
Would you say there has been a legitimate investigation on Chinese soil, or has it basically been sandbagged?
It was sandbagged. I mean, there have been three WHO missions to Wuhan since this disease started. Two of them were one-day affairs a year and a half ago. The more serious one was in January and February of this year, but also that really was preordained because the Chinese really made it very clear who was and who was not going to be part of that investigation. They hindered the mission by not turning over raw patient data, especially those 174 cases that could have revealed the source of the disease. And they were heavily involved in writing the report. Matter of fact, Tedros said that there were some errors in the report that they wanted to correct. He did say that they wouldn't change the conclusion of the WHO report from the January-February mission, but he said he wanted to make them anyway. And really what we're looking at is just inevitable momentum pushing towards the notion that SARS-CoV-2, the pathogen causing COVID-19, it came from a lab.
Well, you tweeted on Friday afternoon, there is something very strange about this hardy disease which continues to hobble the world. It is in many respects an ideal biological weapon.
Yes. Well, first of all, you know, we've now got the Delta variant. The epidemiologists, you know, they're all saying, look, this is going to hit us with us by storm because it seems to be much more transmissible. It really hit India a couple months ago. And it's going around the world. We really don't know where this disease came from in the sense that we don't have absolute 100% proof. But, you know, diseases are supposed to get weaker and less transmissible over time. This one is actually picking up steam. So that's really, really strange. And what I meant was when I said that, look, this is an ideal biological weapon, you don't have to kill a lot of people to cripple a society. And what this disease is doing is crippling societies around the world. That does make it ideal. Matter of fact, you know, as they say in the military, sometimes you don't want to kill your opponent. You want to just wound them because it takes a lot of effort on the part of your enemy to take soldiers off the battlefield, take care of them. Well, that's really what's going on here as well. You know, we've got right now, you know, hospitalizations, all the rest of it. This is a really good biological weapon.
I want to turn to Cuba because most people would talk about the relationship of Cuba and Russia because obviously of the history and the Cuba Missile Crisis and everything. But what about the relationship of China to today's Cuba?
Well, China has, in many respects, taken over the role of the Soviet Union in supporting the communist regime on the island. It's got, for instance, it's taken over the Lourdes facility, which is a big listening post. It was the largest Soviet listening post outside of the Soviet Union. Well, the Chinese have taken it over, you know, and they've got all of these economic projects throughout the island. The Chinese have promised more than they've delivered, but they promised quite a lot. And China, along with Venezuela, are really the main backers of the Castro regime, now taken over by somebody that they put in there, you know, who's a non-entity. But right now, I think that you can say that China is very much involved in propping up the regime. You know, we hear all these propaganda blasts from Beijing. The Castro regime is there because of China.
What is it about Cuba you think that really explains why China is so interested in them?
I think it's because China's not, you know, not that interested in what it actually has on the island right now. I think that they really are concerned about what destitute Cubans can do to change history. You know, as Freedom House says, we're in the 15th year of a democracy recession, and that Beijing loves that. But if the Castro regime were to fall, I mean, if we were to see Diaz-Canel, their president, you know, have to flee, well, that actually would change history because it could start a new democracy movement around the world. And so I think that they're worried that destitute Cubans can bring down more than just one communist regime.
Gordon Chang. Follow him on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. Thank you so much as always, Gordon. Interesting, interesting perspectives.
Well, thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate it.
7:27 Saturday morning update on WMAL. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer coming up and KT McFarland, so stick around.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station. News now.
WMAL News at 7:30. Good morning. I'm Heather Curtis. Some sad news out of Southeast D.C. A 6-year-old girl was shot and killed last night at the intersection of MLK Jr. and Malcolm X Avenues in Congress Heights. Executive Assistant Police Chief Ashawn Benedict.
In total, there were 6 victims, 5 adults, 1 6-year-old female. Of the 5 adults, 3 of them were male, 2 of them were female. Of those 5, they're in area hospitals with non-life-threatening injuries.
No word on who pulled the trigger. Police are looking for a dark-colored car. As life begins to return to normal, COVID cases are spiking, according to Johns Hopkins University.
On Thursday, it was about 28,000. By Friday, it more than doubled to just over 77,000. With the highly contagious Delta variant spreading, COVID cases are climbing in every state. Hospitalizations and deaths are rising among unvaccinated people. And the nation's vaccination drive is slow to a crawl with only about 48% of the population fully protected. Jill Nato, Fox News.
On a hot day like today, you often find random people selling water out of coolers on the National Mall. Park police say they're going to go back to enforcing a ban on unlicensed vendors. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton wants them to exercise maximum restraint when they do that, especially when it's kids. WMAL Sports, the Nats fell to the Padres 24-8. Traffic and weather next on WMAL. WMAL traffic, here's Michelle Murray in the Hadid Carpet Cleaning Traffic Center.
In Virginia and Falmouth on 95 southbound, approaching Warrington Road, watch out for an accident blocking the left lane and traffic is slow from Garrisonville, Aquia. Earlier work zone in Arlington on 395 southbound after the GW Parkway, looks like that has been cleared away. On 95 southbound at 198 Laurel, watch out for some debris in the roadway. And in the district, inbound Suitland Parkway at the Anacostia Freeway, there is construction along the left side. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Hot and humid again to start the weekend. A heat advisory is in effect as we go through the afternoon and evening. It will feel like close to 105 degrees, but high temperatures today should reach once again into the mid-90s. Now, a cold front will shift through later on today, bringing the chance for some heavy storms this afternoon and evening. A flash flood watch is in effect for the D.C. Metro through late tonight. Some very heavy rainfall in the forecast. Also, some isolated damaging winds. Heading overnight, storms will come to an end. Lows back to 70s for your Sunday. Partly sunny, not as hot. Temperatures back into the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
I'm Heather Curtis on 105.9 FM, Washington's Mall, WMAL.
It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Great to have you with us. I'm Rick Fowler, and we're joined by Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. He is the author of Operation Dark Heart. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Research and the co-host of the Thought to Action podcast. Tony, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Rick. Always great to join you.
Tony, we've been talking this morning, obviously, about the protests in Cuba.
Right.
And you have an angle on it. You know, Tony and I will get together on Friday night and figure out, you know, what do we want to talk about tomorrow. And you have an angle on what's going on in Cuba that I had not been aware of. And I will just read the headline and you can tell us what's happening. This is from Reuters. Fake news muddies online waters during Cuba protests. Explain that.
Yeah, imagine that. Well, there's a propaganda war going on as much as a real revolution behind the scenes. And, you know, what's interesting is that we see the end result here of how our media kind of shapes this, you know, and they always throw COVID and, oh, they're upset about COVID. But people don't recognize how there's internal propaganda. And one of the grand ironies I think most people who actually pay attention see is Jane Psaki, the spokesman, talking during the same briefing about how they're targeting Americans and shutting off their access to social media and the internet, and then calling out the Cubans for shutting off people's access to the internet and access. It's a Maoist calling out Stalinist. It's really kind of that bizarre. But what people don't understand is that there's a real battle going on behind the scenes on this that I think is people should be paying attention to, because obviously the way information flows, the nature of how we communicate and seek to understand the situation around us is going to be very much, you know, kind of on display now through this. There's going to be protests in Washington. There's going to be more of this behind the scenes stuff. So I recommend everybody who really wants to pay attention to what the Biden administration is trying to do, what the global media is trying to make you think, I'll pay very close attention as this whole kind of propaganda war plays out before us.
From your sense of things, and I know you don't have a crystal ball, but would you say that where we are at the end of the week is indicative of what happens next? In other words, the reports are that things are calm in Cuba and that the protests have been met by police and even Cuban government sympathizers. Is this going to just quiet down, or will they be re-energized or reinvigorated?
Well, the question is, you know, about how much can the people continue to maintain their effort without a military crackdown? I think, obviously, there's a tipping point that has to be reached. This happened in East and West Germany, East Berlin, West Berlin, where the forces of the government just simply could not stop the momentum of popular uprising. And I think, I don't know if we're there yet or not, But one of the grand ironies here, just before we go on this topic, is that I've seen our side say, oh, all these sanctions are the reason that the people are upset. It's like, Rick, the rest of the world has no sanctions. If Cuba system worked, it could be prosperous because of all the trade with all the other countries. So just keep in mind that as you see that, the real effort here is to try to blame the United States for the Cubans' internal problems, and I hope the Cuban people see that and understand that they need to kind of just throw off their own government, go in the direction they want for their own prosperity.
Well, there's so much attention paid to the U.S. embargo, right. And with the Obama administration outreach to Cuba at the time, where he had loosened up some of the restrictions and there was dialogue, Obama even went to Cuba.
Right.
But even with all of that, the government would not make enough concessions in order to get the embargo lifted. So I don't understand how there is so much criticism of the embargo when the Cuban government itself could have done something about it when they had talks with President Obama.
Like I said, it's all part of the propaganda game right now, Rick. And again, I encourage people to watch closely what you just said and everything else is going on.
Want to turn to Afghanistan because there is a lot of concern about what's going to happen to the women in Afghanistan. A side note, Danish Siddiqui was a Reuters journalist. He was killed in the crossfire earlier this week. He was traveling with a convoy of commandos. It came under heavy fire from Taliban militants on the outskirts of Kandahar. Give us a sense of what is going to continue to roll out in Afghanistan as the United States troops move out.
So, I've seen on my Twitter feed women critical of my lack of interest in this regarding Afghanistan, regarding what happens to women. It's not because I lack interest in women. Anybody reads my book, Operation Darkheart, which talks about my time there, I'm just very interested in the topic. The issue is it's time for the Afghan people to stand up and organize around their own self-interests. And that means the women of Afghanistan must stand up with their men, with the men, and do what they can to establish a governance that goes forward that they can live with. It's not our job to help them pick their governance. And as much as that's sad, as much as it's sad that we've invested billions of dollars in schools and women's programs, those are all great things. But then again, Rick, those are all nation building things. Those are us projecting our social and cultural will on the people of Afghanistan. So now it's up to them to make the choice. What I think is going to be very interesting is the power vacuum that's left. That who goes into it? How is it actually used for the purposes of other international entities? And right now, China looks like it's actually poised to move in, although the Chinese now recognizing that we were providing security for their access to Afghanistan is now stating that they're unhappy with our pullout. So a lot of people are very unhappy with us, and that's I'm sorry, but it's time that the Afghan people make their own choices. After the Revolutionary War, Rick, we did not have the French come in and then push on to us French culture. Otherwise, we'd all be, eating escargot and that sort of thing. I'm just saying that, the Afghan people now are responsible for their own path forward, and that's what we, I think, need to hope and encourage them to do.
All right, so there's a dust-up and back and forth this week between former President Trump and the current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley. And there were some comments attributed to Milley and comments attributed to Trump coming out in a book. Kind of summarize what's going on and where this goes.
So basically, to make it a very kind of concise summary, there's the book paints a very bad picture of Mark Milley, depending on one's perspective. My perspective is bad by the fact that it appears to show that he was disloyal to the man who he had to answer to. That's the appearance. Now, there's been no comment from Mark, to be fair to Mark. And I know some folks have reached out to Mark and offered him a platform to come and talk about some of this stuff to get his side out. But until Mark speaks out, until General Milley speaks out, and clarifies if he said him or not, I guess we're all going to be kind of waiting. President Trump is kind of engaged with him on this issue. And I think General Milley does owe the American people an answer. I think there was some clear indicators. Some of the articles out this week, Rick, kind of highlight the things he did or did not do during his time as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs under President Trump. The Vindman chapter, I think, is very telling by the fact that before he was chairman, he was chief of staff of the Army. And, you know, there were some things that I think happened during that time that indicated to me and others that Vindman had done things and said things which would have gotten other lesser officers relieved instantly or moved on. And I think it's going to be interesting. But I do believe Milley has the obligation to get out and say something. Otherwise, right now, the things that have been said about him are going to stand. And it doesn't. They do not paint a portrayal of a man of great courage or ability to actually work and support the man he was obligated to follow based on his oath.
And real quick, Thought to Action yeah. podcast. What's up this week?
So we're continuing to do a series on China, on just China Red Alerts, called this name of the series. And we're kind of going through and doing a detailed review of the spectrum of things we have to observe regarding China. We actually had journalist Claudia Rosette. She's also a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. She joined us to talk about her experience in Hong Kong. So I think everybody would learn a lot and enjoy the podcast. So thanks for having me, Rick.
You betcha. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer. Find out more at londoncenter.org. We're at 7:45 Saturday morning update, WMAL. KT McFarland is next. But first, Michelle Murray's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Falmouth, watch out for an accident on 95 southbound approaching Warrington Road with the left lane blocked and traffic is slow headed from Aquia Harbor. Also expect delays right now if you're traveling northbound headed from Quantico towards Dumfries Road. And also you will find some slow going traffic right now if you're traveling on the Prince William Parkway southbound south of 66 with construction taking up two lanes. Right now, if you're traveling in the district, there is road work inbound on the Suitland Parkway at the Anacostia Freeway along the left side of the roadway. Watch for delays from 1st Sterling Avenue. Now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
This will be the last day of the heat wave. High temperatures into the mid-90s. A heat advisory is in effect noon through 8 o'clock this evening, D.C. and points east. Also, a cold front will shift through during the afternoon. A flash flood watch is in effect for the D.C. and Baltimore metros through the overnight hours. Could have some very heavy rainfall thinking through the afternoon and evening. Some storms may be on the strong to severe side with damaging winds as well. Storms will come to an end overnight for your Sunday. Partly sunny skies. Temperatures a little bit cooler back in the mid-80s. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Lee at the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
79 degrees, 7:47 on the Saturday morning update. 7:49 on the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us this weekend. We are joined by KT McFarland, President Trump's first Deputy National Security Advisor. She is the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. KT, good morning.
Good morning.
So I was looking at your website, ktmcfarland.com. You have an article, it says, if war comes, will the United States Navy be prepared? The Navy is so focused on cultural issues that it has shortchanged war-fighting capabilities. The wokeness has come at a price, less and less focus on actual war-fighting. Now, you, as a former Deputy National Security Advisor, I would think you would be very knowledgeable on what is the threat here.
Yeah, what happened was... Before the Biden defense cuts, so it's even worse since then, a group of senators and congressmen said, you know, look, the Navy's had a lot of accidents at sea. What's going on here? And so they commissioned a study, an independent study, and unlike most studies of this type, which are go to a think tank, ask a bunch of desk, you know, admirals, what do you think, or have the chain of command go to the Secretary of the Navy and say, what's going on here? At which point everything is all sanitized, they actually went to the sailors, to the officers and senior enlisted who were in active duty or recently retired, and offered them anonymity, so your names are going to be known, and then said, we're not going to run this up the chain of command. We're just going to talk to you and find out what your real thoughts are. So it was a completely candid study and in-depth interviews with these enlisted and officers, and the conclusion, like 97%, was that the Navy is not prepared to fight the next war at sea. And they listed a couple of examples of why. One is the heavy bureaucratization of the Navy. So everything is filled out in triplicate, and the oversight of and the micromanagement of a lot of the officers at sea is so apparent that when a naval officer is on the deck of a ship, for example, a surface ship, and he's so sort of looked over the shoulder that he's never develops any independent sense of how do you take a risk, how do you deal with a situation you're not expecting to deal with. And yet the first thing that happens in a war with the Navy is that they'll knock out communication, so that ship captain is on his own. He better innovate, he better be creative on his own. And that ability wasn't there. The other is that the massive cutbacks in training, operations, and maintenance. So, you know, historically, if a naval officer was going to go to a ship, he got trained for the job that he was going to take before he went to the ship. So when he arrived at the ship, he was more or less ready to assume his duties. Now, you're just sent to the ship and handed a bunch of CDs and said, okay, read, you know, watch these CDs in your spare time. That'll teach you how to do your job. Well, you know, none of these things prepare the Navy, but the most searing criticism of all was the wokeism, that by focusing on wokeism and cultural issues and all the other stuff the Navy has now become, it was something fell out of the bottom of it, of their studies and their training, and what fell out of the bottom was the real purpose of the Navy, which is warfighting. So it was devastating in every way. And it wasn't just a research problem. It's like you can't throw just more money at it and expect a better result. This is a fundamental problem of the Navy. And I think if it doesn't get changed and turned around fast, we're in big trouble, because the most likely war of the future is not going to be a land war in the Middle East. It's going to be a naval battle in the South China Sea, with China as our near, if not equal, peer competitor.
I want to turn to Cuba. You have an interesting perspective on not the political situation in Cuba, but the political situation in the United States when it comes to Cuba.
Here's the problem. The United States has, since the Kennedy administration, advocated for democracy in Cuba. And somehow the Democrats have gotten so twisted around that they have a small percentage of the Democrat Party, just a handful of people, but they're critical votes that the Democrats and the Biden administration needs to pass its super radical agenda, socialist agenda, and it needs these couple of votes. Well, the problem is these congressmen and one or two senators, they love communist Cuba. They've gone out time and time again to say it's a great country, it's a great government, it's a wonderful setup, everything works fine. And yet you now have massive, spontaneous demonstrations throughout Cuba by all, you know, ethnic groups, all age groups, all socioeconomic groups of the Cuban society are saying, we don't like our communist government. They're corrupt. They're incompetent. They're stealing money and resources and medical supplies from the rest of the population, and they're living like kings. So it's this awkward position that the Democrats are in. Are they really supporting the communist government, not the people who want free democracy? Yes, sort of seems like they are. And I just keep looking, thinking back to my era in the Reagan administration and the collapse of the Soviet Union, and all those communist countries in Eastern Europe, Poland, Czechoslovakia then, East Germany, Hungary, they all demonstrated against the communist government, and the United States cheered them on. And so the Berlin Wall fell, we won the Cold War. But now it seems like the United States, at least in the Biden administration, they're not cheering anybody on. They're not cheering on democracy. They're suspiciously silent. And the things that they could do, which are so simple, it would be just a matter of reinstating the Internet to the people in Cuba. I mean, you could do that with a couple of drones, with beaming the signal down. They're not doing any of this stuff, and they're sort of tap dancing and making a bunch of excuses of why they're not supporting democracy. And then the Biden administration said, and if any of those pro-democracy demonstrators get on ships and come to the United States, we're turning you guys right around. I mean, really? The United States is now promoting communist governments? What the heck has happened to our country?
Well, the reason they don't want them to come to Florida is because they would likely end up as Republican voters in the future.
Yeah, they're pro-democracy, right? They're pro-free market. They would, but, you know, they don't want to have any of those people come into the United States. Look, I think the bigger picture, though, Rick, of what's happening is that I've spent my whole life studying revolutions, I mean, Marx, Engels, Lenin, Mao, and I've looked at sort of what are the things that they all have in common. Even if you go back and look at fascism and Nazism, they immediately infiltrate and then seize control of a couple of key organs of society. First of all, they take the treasury. Well, that's sort of what's happening with Biden's spending plan, right? He's seizing control of the American economy, and he's going to take all the money from everybody. Government takes its rather substantial cut, and then they distribute it to the people in exchange for votes. They seize education. Well, that's what critical race theory has done, is it takes over the education system of the country, and it takes it away from state and local government and puts it into the hands of the federal government. They're seizing elections, which constitutionally are supposed to be in the hands of the states, and their excuse is, well, the states can't be trusted. Federal government's got to run that. Well, defunding the police, another thing revolutions always do is get rid of law enforcement and police, and then they enforce the laws they want. And communications, that's what all revolutions do, is they take charge of communications, they tip them their way, even if they're taking charge by infiltrating just a small number of people to control them. And so then they control all these major elements of society, and then they change. And what the Democrats are proposing to do isn't just the normal give and take of American politics, where you go a little left, you go a little right, you know, you change administrations, a little tinkering around the edges. They want to completely change America from free market capitalist society into socialism, and from two-party rule into one-party rule. And even Joe Biden himself said that. He was asked, well, are you going to run in the 2024 election? Is Trump going to run? Is he going to be the Republican nominee? And Biden, it let it slip, and he said, well, is there even going to be a Republican Party in 2024? Their goal is not the give and take of Republican and Democrat electoral politics in the United States. Their goal is complete takeover by one party, and the party seems to be listing rather left.
K.T. McFarland, the author of Revolution, Trump, Washington, and We the People. As always, K.T., thank you for your unique perspectives on these news stories of the day. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
It is 7:58. That's it for the Saturday morning update. Thank you for being with us. And Garden Sense follows the 8 o'clock news on WMAL.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington. America's reopening. Hear it here. 105.9 FM, WMAL. A Cumulus station.